Hi, welcome to True Creeps, where the stories are true and the creeps are real. We'll cover stories from grotesque gore to the possibly plausible paranormal, to horrifying history, to tense and terrible true crime, and everything else that goes bump in the night. We're your hosts, Amanda.
And I'm Lindsay, and we want you to join us while we creep.
We cover mature topics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody. Today, we're talking about tulpas.
Yeah.
We're going to dive deep into tulpas today.
It's what everyone wants.
It's what the people crave, is diving deep into a tulpa. This is going to be our first tulpa episode. We already have the next one mostly researched. It was supposed to be in this, but it was simply too much. But okay, before we get into it, I just want to urge you to open your mind. And I say that because when we started researching, there was no one there to say that to us. And we didn't realize that, like, philosophically,
yeah,
as like a thing we'd need to understand. And like, not that that's always difficult. It's just more that I wasn't planning on that. I was like, we're gonna find weird things on the internet, you know, like,
as we do.
Not I'm gonna learn about myself. Before we get into it, we're gonna give you the definition that we had for a tulpa when we came into this, what we thought it was, which was a creature, entity, being that is created from someone's thoughts. And so we were like, that's what a tulpa is.
Yeah, that's kind of what we've been told, though.
Yeah, it's what we've been told
through, like, movies and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, which is largely how we learn about tulpas, unless you're, like, looking for it, which now there's a lot you can learn about tulpas. So much you can learn about tulpas. But let's talk about how we get to that concept that we have today. It's commonly held that the concept behind tulpas are rooted in Tibetan Buddhism. One of the sources that we read for today, and we read many, was an article that's called Tracking the Tulpa, Exploring the Tibetan Origins of a Contemporary Paranormal Idea by Natasha Michaels and Joseph Laycock. We don't always give you full-length article names, but when we're going to be using some of their theories, it just feels appropriate. We're like, this is how they saw it, and we agree.
Exactly. Yeah.
They synthesized a lot of information. We synthesized a lot of information. I felt, like, good in my brain that I was like, I feel like I agree with them. Not that I am by any means anyone who, you know, but the fact is, like, they...
No. Tell the people your new job role.
Tulpa scientist.
Yeah, so you have authority now.
Oh, shit. Okay. Stamp of approval.
Yeah. Yeah. Stamp.
But okay. So in their article, Michaels and Laycock, basically, what they suggest is that while everyone else thinks, oh, this is fully originated from Tibetan Buddhism, and everything else is just kind of, like, glommed onto it along the way, perhaps that's not true. Perhaps theosophy, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, took an initial concept from Tibetan Buddhism and it changed a bit. And it's that change that is the tulpa. And we'll talk about this more as we go, but the concept of tulpas as we understand them does not exist in Tibetan archival sources. So it's hard to say, hey, this is rooted in exactly this, when it doesn't exist in that space. And the way in which they do talk about something that is similar is vastly different. So one of the scholars that we'll talk more about in a bit, her name is Alexandra David Neal. She traveled to Asia and she was the first person to write about tulpas. She describes them in relation to Tibetan tulkus. And so this is where that similarity goes. And we're not going to go too deeply into the Buddhist traditions of tulkus and the surrounding ideologies, simply because, one, we are not experts on that. And two, because I think that we can talk just enough about what we need to say this is not the same as a tulku. Tulkus are considered to be purposeful physical manifestations of deities or spiritual leaders. And the purpose of those physically manifested deities or spiritual leaders is to help ease suffering. When you're thinking of a tulpa, that's already very different. We didn't say it before, but we said, you know, a creature made from thought. Some people think that it's intentional thought. Some people think that you can accidentally do it. But you can't have an accidental tulpa be the same thing as something that you have to purposefully create. So they're already different. Tulpas are typically not all created with one purpose. It typically differs for the person.
Yeah.
But tulkus, they're created for the purpose of alleviating suffering through teaching Buddhism. And so...
Right. So there's not a lot of wiggle room there.
Yeah, there's no wiggle room. It is this religious practice versus it's this mystical thing that one can do.
Right. So Alexandra David Neal defined tulpas as, quote,
magical creations produced by a strong concentration of thought. And then Walter Evan Wentz, who wrote the Tibetan Book of Great Liberation, expanded on David Neal's discussion. And what he added was that tulkus were typically an incarnate deity and tulpas were magically produced illusions or creations. So again, differentiating the two. The way that David Neal defined tulpas is rooted in theosophy. And what that is an occult movement that began with the writings of Helena Blavatsky in 1875. There are different forms of theosophical speculation, but there are uniting characteristics in each. So there's an emphasis on mystical experience, and there's also an underlying theme of divine wisdom, which can be used to understand the world and ourselves. Per the Theosophical Society of America, they believe that the truth is a prize, not something that should be imposed by authority. So essentially, the idea is that part of the goal of life is to figure out what the truth is, and it's not to have an authority tell you what the truth is.
I like it.
Yeah. However, to be a member, you must agree to three beliefs. So one, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. Two, to encourage the comparative study of religion, philosophy, and science. And three, to investigate unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in humanity.
I mean, I like it so far.
Right? Like, I'm not mad.
Yeah.
Theosophical views have been held by Freemasons and the Rosicrucians. And if you're like, oh, that sounds familiar, we talked about the Rosicrucians in our Georgia Guidestones episode.
This is also just a note. It might behoove you that in the next couple weeks before our next Tulpa episode comes out, you go listen to the Georgia Guidestone episode for the first time, maybe for the second time, third time even. Sure. Go listen to it three times. I don't know if anybody's listening to us that many times in a row, but, you know, because there's going to be some references that, I mean, you'll be fine either way, but it'll be funnier if if you know.
Nothing can bite through a Georgia Guidestone.
I completely forgot about that joke.
Yeah, I guess it's been a minute. Anyways, back to this. Theosophy's convergence with tulpas begins with theosophical theories of thought forms. And we'll talk about more of what thought forms are in a moment. But in 1903, Bertram Keightley, an English theosophist, suggested that ghosts might be thought forms rather than spirits.
I already like it. One of my favorite things about this research in particular is that it made me reconsider a lot of things we've talked about. And also just like life, man.
She's like, I've been thinking about life a lot this week.
Honestly, I have. I've been thinking about tulpas a lot. And people want to talk to me and I'm like, no, it's great that you want to talk about that. I want to talk about tulpas. So from what we've seen, Andy Pesant's 1905 book, Thought Forms, is one of the leading books to discuss thought forms in that period. It's interesting to note that the idea of thought forms developed independently of Tibetan Buddhist understanding of tulkus. And so it's interesting that you kind of have this similar type of thing that is being considered in the world and in two different lenses. And it's when David Neal goes to Asia that theosophy and Tibetan Buddhism kind of converge together to create the tulpa. But in order to understand that, you need to understand what the fuck a thought form is. So... Guys.
So define it, Lindsay. What is it?
Well, I can't yet. We'll get there.
Oh, fuck.
Don't worry. There's a section. Now, should you be so inclined, Thought Forms is available on the Project Gutenberg website for free, so you can read it. It's also not an incredibly long read. If you're a person who's into things like auras or people's vibrations, then you'll like this. But even if you're not, I think that you'll like the ideas of this, because everyone that I've ever met, that sounds like I'm the problem. Most people have experienced feeling like when someone else's energy is off.
Yeah.
And knowing what that feels like. And so this is kind of like, maybe this is why.
Right.
The purpose of thought forms is to define what a thought form is, right? Which is a form that is made from thought. I know, shocking. The primary purpose of the book really does seem to be to define what a thought is. Did you think that we were going here today? Did you think we were going to talk about what the nature of thinking and thought was? I bet you didn't. And here you are.
I've already fallen down rabbit holes.
Now you're stuck and you have to hear the interesting things, more interesting things about tulpas. You have to learn about what thought is.
Well, I feel like everyone in the last year or two maybe have fallen into that discussion of how people think and like what your mind actually does versus the next person. So I feel like they've touched on the surface of this.
I mean, it's also kind of just like the nature of thinking. Is a thought objectively true? Is it your truth? Is it a fleeting just kind of statement? Because there's things that I think in my brain that I do not believe. That I don't think that they come from somewhere else. I just think that it's like a passing statement that I may reject or accept. Changing how you think is crucial to changing how you act. But that's not an easy thing to do. You can do it gently, but it takes time. But anyway, let's get back to what we're talking about. Bazant, she describes that there are two planes, the astral plane and the mental plane. The mental plane is what we call the physical world. And each person has an aura. And that is your astral body. And it extends outside of the physical body you have. There's some people who can see auras. They say they can see it like kind of floating around a person, kind of like a highlighter around them. And Bazant talks about how thoughts can create permanent change within a person's aura. I promise we'll get to thought forms in a moment, but this is important to understand first. So basically, say you have an aura of a person who is generally calm and kind, right? But you start thinking and feeling like really angry, right? Like something makes you mad and you hold on to it. The thoughts that you have also have their own vibrations, and those vibrations, it's a different color. And I say thought, but like thought slash feeling, because where does the line between one end and the other begin?
Yeah.
These different colors of your thoughts and feelings can affect your aura over time, because just like dropping a little bit of red paint would change a blue over time, thoughts can affect your blue aura. She also discusses how vibrations of others' thoughts might affect other people. So a person who's like vibrating very intensely in anger, you might feel that even if you're not angry. Or if a person's thoughts are very clear, loud, they may influence a person who was more malleable. So when you're thinking of influencing others with your thoughts and feelings, that's when you start to get into that realm of thought forms. And when you're thinking of the strength of them, the quality of the thought determines the color of it. The nature of the thought determines how it looks. The definiteness of the thought determines the clearness of the outline. Thinking of like just like how sturdy it would be. If you're really sure of this thought, then it's going to be more sturdy than if you were like, maybe I should consider this. So as we continue on with thought forms, Bazant describes three different types. And the first is situations where the person is thinking of themselves in some faraway place. And they're like, man, I really wish I was there. Kind of like daydreaming, is what it sounds like to me-ish. But it's almost like you're experiencing yourself in that other place. Like, you're like, oh, I remember how it felt to be there. And in that first example, your astral self goes to that place. And in that second example, you will feel like you are there. So it's kind of like bringing the place to you rather than you going to the place. We've talked about situations with astral projection.
Yeah.
And how that might be ghosts. And that's really what that sounds like to me.
It does. Yeah.
Another thought form is another person or an object. And that's when a person thinks of someone other than themselves or an object and they create an astral version of it. Again, could be ghosts in my opinion. And the third thought form is a unique entity. And it's in this version that a spirit of a person or a nature spirit could actually step in and influence how that thought form behaves. So think of it as this concrete thing that exists that you're manifesting, but could be controlled by either someone's ghost or like something from nature. An example that I've seen about like trying to explain this theory is that if you think of a writer who is like thinking of a storyline in mind and they have their characters developed and they have an idea of how the story is going to unfold, they then, as they're writing the story takes a completely different path. It ends differently. They introduce more characters. Other things happen. With this theory, there's a suggestion that perhaps in this thought and this thought form of like the creation of writing, like a dead writer may have stepped in to that thought form. Or a nature spirit may have stepped in to be like, what if this happened?
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's very interesting. People have talked about like the process of writing can sometimes be trance-like. And if you think about automatic writing, it could feel that way.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When we're talking about things that can actually be illustrated by most people, it's going to be that unique entity. Because per Bazant, it's only a person who is clairvoyant or has the ability to see auras that's going to see the other two auras because they exist on the astral plane. And so she also goes into the fact that thought forms can be directed by others. We're not going to get into this too much, but it's interesting the idea of thinking that like you can purposely send vibrations to another person for good or for bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea and the way that she talks about it is that a person with like a high vibration, if a person is sending like negativity at them,
yeah,
at a low vibration, it'll just bounce off. Like it's not even gonna sink. And then it bounces off with the same propulsion. If you sent nasty thoughts, it's coming right back at you.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. You kind of see that happen.
Yes. But so because these are kind of radical at the time, right? Bazant's theories begin to spread throughout European occult circles.
Makes sense. So let's circle back to Alexandra David Neal. And like we've talked about, they may have been influenced by theosophical theories as well as Tibetan Buddhism. So in her book, Magic and Mystery, which was written in 1929, David Neal recounts experiences. And one of the things that she wrote was, quote, "Once the tulpa is endowed with enough vitality to be capable of playing the part of a real being, it tends to free itself from its maker's control. Sometimes the phantom becomes a rebellious son, and one hears of uncanny struggles that have taken place between magicians and their creatures, the former being severely hurt or killed by the latter." So she claims to have observed mystical Tibetan practices in the 20th century. And she describes tulpas as, quote, "magical creations produced by a strong concentration of thought," which we kind of already defined it like that, right? "Tulpas, once they manifest in the physical world, may interact with its surroundings." David Neal describes tulpas as very rare. Makes sense. She says that Tibetan Buddhism sees mental and physical energy as the same thing. So concentration in mental can cause the physical changes.
Okay, and then that makes sense for also theosophy.
Yeah. "The time to create a tulpa is dependent on the skill of the practitioner." So you have to be a tulpa scientist.
One might say a tulpamancer. Not here. Oh. Not here, though. Not here. They're not saying that. Later. Later we say it.
So someone that she was meeting for the first time appeared with a fiery deity trailing behind them. So David Neal was like to this person, "Are you by chance visualizing a tulpa that is fiery?" And the person's like, "Yep. Yes, I am." So she was able to see it. Interesting and a little scary.
Interesting. Interesting.
So after David Neal had been living in Tibet for several years, she set out to create her own tulpa. And she took part in a multi-month meditation practice. And she said that she created a monk that looked like Friar Tuck. We've talked about the Friar Tuck haircut before, just to visualize it.
We have.
Other people saw him too. And David Neal recounts that she would have thought that she made up her own hallucination if others had not seen it as well. And specifically, it was Tibetan herdsmen that saw David Neal's tulpa, a Friar Tuck. When it began to become more independent, she had to remove it through several months of meditation. So she's meditating for a long, long time, both to create it and then to get rid of it.
It's a little bit more alarming when you're like, it can't just go away.
No, like you have to like take time. I mean, maybe someone that's done this multiple times could get like better at it, but still like unsettling.
Perhaps. Yes. Like, what are you going to do? Kill it? You have to absorb it.
All I think of is the rice doll.
Oh, God.
Why? But please don't make a tulpa of the rice doll.
That sounds terrible.
It does. It does. So when both David Neal and Walter Evan Wentz, who we briefly mentioned earlier, traveled to Asia, they each communicated via translators.
And interestingly, from what we understand, there were several translators that were present throughout this, but the primary translator that each of them used was the same. And that translator's name was Kazi Dawa Samdub. They were trained at a school that was formed to train interpreters and geographers. That makes sense. But there was like a little bit of like an undercurrent with that, and that there was pressure that the people that they trained would go forth and promote British interests. So that's there. When you're thinking of the idea of like something being lost in translation, it's often because there's just not words in the other language to describe whatever it is. You don't often think about the bias that exists in the person that is doing the interpreting. and that if words don't exist in one language, how they choose to translate it might vary based on the person and their own beliefs. And so in the article we discussed earlier, Michaels and Laycock talk about that it's very likely that Samdup influenced how David Neal and Wentz understood Talpas. David Neal describes Samdup as, quote, an occultist and even, in a certain way, a mystic. So it's hard for me to think that they wouldn't have influenced how they were looking at it, how they were looking at the Buddhist ideas. And when you're thinking of it in this way, imagine interpreter has theosophical kind of ideas in their head, and they're talking to people who know a bit about theosophy, right? And they're translating this Buddhist Tibetan discourse, but they're doing it through the lens of theosophy. So like, even if, say, David Neal did not have any theosophical background, they could still get to theosophy being part of the way that it's described because the translator had that lens of understanding. And that's one of the ways in which they were framing it to David Neal and Wentz. So are we getting more of a clear picture of how Talpas are formed? We went from Tibetan talkus to thought forms to Talpas now. We're there. We're here.
And it takes a long time.
We're 4 pages into our outline. Let's define what we're going to call a Talpa for the rest of this episode. And we're using Michaels and Laycock's definition because it was gorgeous. So a Talpa is an entity that can be created by anyone, usually inadvertently, exists independently of its creators, is sentient and capable of rebellion, and is frightening, if not dangerous.
What I find interesting is that you can inadvertently create it, but it takes so much time.
Now that I'm a Talpa scientist. Okay, so there is accidental creation in terms of how many people are concentrated on this thing. Like, for example, say hundreds of thousands, millions of people thought something existed and they thought about it in the same way. Couldn't they create that?
I think so. That's what I'm saying. It's like that part's interesting that you could essentially like accidentally do something without knowing it.
Yeah. Well, and it's also like a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. If you're like, I'm going to see a ghost in this house. Did the ghost exist before you believed there was a ghost in the house? We talked about in our Queen Mary episode that the fake haunted room eventually became not fake haunted. And to me, that's a lovely example of a talpa of a place and how you can change a place based on belief and our perception of realities.
But it took time.
It took time. It took thought.
Yes, it took time.
You're thinking of like this very distinct form of like, I mean, they're a room, but Friar Tuck, right? She was creating that talpa of this person that looked in a certain way. But this can also be done with emotion. So it's not always like, oh, I'm creating this being because I'm meaning to. It can also be from a particular feeling. And so Dion Fortune expanded on this idea of talpa in 1930. And they said that they considered ensouled thought forms to be artificial elementals, right? Because they're not that original, like, feeling, thought, universal, like, gut punch, if you will. They're their own. Like, they're their own. They're a being now. They're not just a feeling. They're an actual thing that has its own thoughts and create its own thought forms, and it's autonomous. And they gave an example of this. So Fortune was incredibly mad at someone. And from the mental energy that she had of just anger and rage, that she was just like thinking at this person. Because if we're thinking of thought forms that can be used in an attack, purposely or not, she's thinking about how mad she is at this person, right? Just so fucking mad. And she says that she created a sentient thought form that manifested in the physical world. And she said it was a werewolf and that it was made of ectoplasm. And she described it as Frankenstein's monster. She said that she was able to draw the creature back into herself before it did anything bad. In my brain, we see ectoplasm. I'm automatically thinking of a talpa of Slimer who's made of ectoplasm because he's made of ectoplasm. And I was like, oh, but like, how interesting that like her rage built that.
And I mean, people say rage is dangerous for a number of reasons, right?
Yes. Well, have you ever seen the movie The Brood?
I don't think so.
She creates tiny little creatures out of anger.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of horror movies that kind of say where people create either like a ghost or create something in their house.
Yes.
I don't want to say it's a common trope, but it's been done. So let's get into some testing for talpas. The Toronto Society for Physical Research conducted a study to gauge the effect of imagination in spiritualism. They invented a spirit that they wanted to contact through a seance that had never existed. His name was Philip Aylesford, and he was an English Civil War veteran. And as a note, the English Civil War was in the mid-1600s. So, unfortunately, their results were inconclusive. There were, however, multiple occasions where the fictionalized spirit made contact. That's wild.
Isn't it? I'm like, ooh.
And a little unsettling.
It's a little unsettling. I mean, I also would say, you know, you're talking a seance. Who's to say that whatever you're talking to is what it's actually saying it is, right? If you're saying, I want to talk to, like, good old Philip, and then insert, like, Zozo, you know, like, being like, I'm Philip, my friends call me Phil.
Right. And I've been reading a lot about prankster spirits lately, too, and how they like to make people fearful and like to pretend to be a number of different things. So, interesting. Michaels and Laycock state that John Keel was the first contemporary paranormal writer that wrote about tulpas in his 1975 book, The Mothman Prophecies, Lindsay's fave.
I don't like the suggestion that Mothman is a tulpa, but he absolutely could be a tulpa now.
Everything's a tulpa. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like everything that we love is a tulpa.
I'm a tulpa.
You're a tulpa.
There's our ending.
You know, I really wanted a really fun podcast host.
Did you dream me up?
I did.
I don't think I would have been the one you dreamed up.
How rude.
Oh, I'm saying that perhaps somebody who could speak is somebody who you would dream of.
Oh, no, I can't speak. I need someone to make, you know, the same things here and there and take turns.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Great.
Yeah. No, it's great. We feed off of one another. It works.
Fantastic.
So Keel noted that reports of paranormal phenomena often mirrored the images that were appearing in pop culture. He also went on to specify that he didn't think that people were lying. Rather, he believed that they weren't encountering ghosts or extraterrestrials. They were experiencing tulpas.
Love it.
Again, I'm not sure. The Blair Witch, though, is real. Just saying. Sorry.
I mean, she could be a tulpa now. Like, she abso-fucking-lutely could be a tulpa now.
I know. That's why I'm so upset.
I mean, especially because, I mean, if you think about it, like, we're giving her, like, so much detail and specificity and thought and, like, who she is and what she does for fun. We're building her. You're welcome, Blair.
Oh, I love that we're making her story, though. Like, her pet.
Yeah.
And her traveling companions.
Yeah. Not just what she did to those people in the woods. She's more than that.
She grew from it. Her anger tulpa that she created, the tulpa made a tulpa.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Stopped.
Mind blown.
All I wanted. Okay, so back to this. One of the examples he gave is that there was a writer in New York City named Walter Gibson who wrote a series of pulp novels called The Shadow. After he passed, people began to report seeing an apparition that matched the description of Gibson's main character.
Wild.
Keel wondered if Gibson's process of writing and intense concentration made him manifest in the physical world. Alvin Schwartz, who was a well-known DC comic writer, wrote about his experience with tulpas in his memoir, and that was published in 2006. He wrote Superman and Batman stories, although he did not create the characters. Schwartz explains that he had become a Buddhist after he met a Tibetan monk. In their conversations, the monk told Schwartz that he, the monk, was a tulpa. Further, the monk told Schwartz that, because of the attention and thought given to Superman, that Superman was also a tulpa now. Wild. So now Superman's running around the world. Flying around the world, I should say. Schwartz claimed to have encountered the Superman tulpa in a New York City cab.
Why not?
He didn't want to fly that day. He wanted to take the cab.
I had so many questions. What do you mean? Why? Was he in his costume? Was it like a comic book version of him? Was it like somebody who'd played Superman?
Well, by that thought, though, couldn't every superhero then be a tulpa? Because so many people are thinking about them at all times.
Well, and because everyone and everything could be a tulpa, therefore no one and nothing could be a tulpa. The world would be fucking overrun with fictional creatures. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe that's what cryptids are. But
yeah, maybe it is. They're all at the bottom of the ocean, though, waiting.
Waiting. Oh my gosh. Okay. So Brad Steiger also wrote about tulpas in 2010, and he talked about how thoughts and emotions can strengthen a tulpa. He said that even the most skilled magicians can lose control of their tulpas. And he not only said that they were uncontrollable, but that topples were outright dangerous. Also, Ed and Lorraine Warren, who most people have heard of already, have said that they have a Halloween mask that could be used in black magic rituals to create tulpas in a film about their museum. And that just feels very, like, salacious and disrespectful of tulpas to be like, use this Halloween mask. It's like
a little bit, yeah.
I just find that so bizarre. But Amanda mentioned at the top of the episode that the average person hears about tulpas from television. And that's where I heard about it for the first time, which I'll talk about in a second. But X-Files in the 90s had tulpa episodes. And where I heard about it was in an episode of Supernatural. They actually ended up having two episodes on tulpas, one of which was inspired by Slender Man, which I thought was really interesting. But also, speaking of Slender Man, he is the most famous alleged tulpa that exists. And so when we're talking about exists, that's kind of in quotes, right? Because we don't know if they do, but he is the one that most people talk about. So that's what we're going to do now.
We will do it on this day, today, now.
Today in my book report, I will
I will discuss
George Washington described
the definition of
the Webster Dictionary defines a tulpa.
Oh, now we're turning into a speech.
Perfect. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Slender Man. So Slender Man was created by Eric Knudsen for a website called Something Awful in 2009. His original posts of Slender Man were posted under the name Victor Surge. And what he was posting for was there was a contest about photoshopping to make it look like something that was not there was there. And the photos are fucking chilling. So, like, he did a great job. The creature that was in there was tall and very thin and had very long limbs, but no face. And so from this, short stories, videos, games, creepypastas, cartoons, memes, every fucking type of thing you can think of was made from it. So some people think, like, what he had made up wasn't actually made up. He thought he was, but it was actually like this ancient creature that has existed in all civilizations, but has no name. And that, like, the inspiration for it that came to him was a knowing of his existence, if you will. But lore about Slender Man has obviously evolved and branched out since its inception. He's considered a modern boogeyman, and that, like, whatever you're scared of, he's going to make it scarier for you. And that, like, he can be scary in so many ways. You know, we're talking tulpas, though. There are many who believe that Slender Man, while imaginary at first, was manifested into the physical world through, you know, not just the person who originally thought of him, which was Chris Knudsen, but also everyone else who continued developing his story and the way he looked and the things that he did. I just find that fascinating, right?
A little terrifying.
Yeah. Knowing, oh, here's where it came from. You're like, oh, this isn't real. But then how do you explain people who are seeing Slender Man? Is it that they're seeing a creature that looked like this? Is it that people were right and there's this, like, ancient, unknowable creature that kind of popped into Knudsen's head? Or through the sheer power of belief and, you know, visualization of this many people, did we make Slender Man real?
I think either way is terrifying.
Agreed.
So let's head on to Waukesha, Washington, and talk about a stabbing involving Slender Man. Well, we got our information from a range of sources. When we were talking about interviews we have seen, it's from the Beware of Slender Man documentary.
It's fantastic, by the way. It's very good.
Mm-hmm. And that documentary talks about a lot of different things involving Slender Man, but we're only going to talk about this crime today. In May of 2014, Morgan Geyser and Anissa Wire invited their classmate, Peyton, or Bella, she went by Bella, Lautner, to a sleepover at Geyser's home. All the girls were 12 years old. And the next day, the three girls went to a nearby park, and that was called the Nicolet National Forest. Geyser and Wire told Bella that they were going to play hide and seek. Geyser and Wire held Bella down. Then Wire told Geyser, quote, go ballistic, go crazy. And Geyser stabbed her 19 times with a 5-inch knife from Geyser's kitchen.
Fuck.
Not always involving Slender Man, which we'll get to, but this has happened multiple times with children, which is just terrifying to think of.
Yes. It also just gets like worse and worse when you realize the relationships between these children.
Yes. So the stab wounds were in her abdomen, arms, and legs. And they fled the scene, leaving Bella for dead. Bella crawled from the woods, and a cyclist found her. And when they did, Bella was barely alive. So when she was asked who attacked her, Bella said, "My best friend." That hurt your heart?
It hurts my heart so fucking bad. Like, ugh.
So Geyser and Wire were found just 4 hours later near Interstate 94. Now, they told authorities that they were walking to Slender Man's mansion. Sure, the person's just like, what the fuck?
Wild.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the investigation. Law enforcement took DNA samples from the girls after they were found, you know, near the I-94. And there's an interview with Geyser. And Geyser asked law enforcement, quote, "Do you know what happened to Bella? She's the one who was stabbed. Is she dead?" And the way she said it is a real monotone voice.
Yeah.
The law enforcement officer says she was taken to the hospital and Geyser snaps her head up. Like, it seemed like she was surprised. She says, quote, "I was just wondering," like trying to cover her tracks there.
Mm-hmm.
Later, the detective asked Geyser if she planned the murder beforehand. And Geyser responded that Wire told her that they had to or he would kill their families. And, you know, when he's like, who? And Geyser's like, quote, "A man." Anissa knows him. Geyser said that Slender Man was a tall, faceless man who preys on children, who was everywhere. She goes on to talk about how he's in her dreams, which means he's stalking you.
Don't like it.
Don't like it at all. She also said that they were planning it since December. So the detective then asked why they chose Bella. And Geyser said it was whoever Wire was talking to that said it had to be Bella. She said that Wire made it seem necessary and that she kept saying it was necessary. And throughout the interview, you could tell that Geyser was scared, but she didn't like seem to feel bad about it, right? Like the way that she spoke and the way, I don't know, just.
Yeah.
Especially like, oh, is she alive?
Yeah.
She didn't seem to care.
So at the same time that they're interviewing Geyser, they're also interviewing Weir. And whatever you think the first question that Weir asked the detective was, whatever you think that question is, you're wrong. Because what Weir asked the detective was, "Do you know how far we walked? I'm not very athletic and I was just curious how far we walked."
What a weird question.
Like, the fuck? And so Weir went on to describe how she learned about Slender Man and how she was scared that he could kill her family in 3 seconds. She also gave like physical descriptions of him and said he could kill her with his tentacles. Weir admitted introducing Geyser to the stories of Slender Man, and that she said that Geyser had told her that when Geyser was 5, she'd seen Slender Man. Weir also said that it was Geyser's idea for the two of them to become proxies, also known as Slender Man's servants, and that in order to do that, they would need to specifically kill Bella. So here she's saying that it was Geyser that said it.
Right.
And this would all be so that they could prove their worthiness to Slender Man.
Gross.
The detective is like, why do you want to prove yourself to him?
Yeah.
She says, quote, "If you're a proxy, you supposedly live in Slender Mansion where all the creepypastas live in. And it's supposedly in the middle of Nicolet National Park. I wanted to prove all the skeptics wrong."
Why?
Yes. Yes. Weir goes on to say that she was surprised about the idea of killing Bella, but also kind of excited.
Gross.
As Amanda mentioned, they didn't seem really remorseful, and law enforcement testified to that. Geyser and Weir were both charged with attempted first-degree intentional homicide as adults. So in that documentary that we talked about, there are interviews with Geyser and Weir's parents as well as a teacher. And Geyser's mother recalls, when she was little, she wouldn't respond to movies in the way that she would think she would. Like, she wouldn't have empathy or be sad. In Bambi, when they watched it, they were a little bit worried about how she would handle the mother dying. But rather than being sad that the mother died, she was like, run, Bambi, save yourself, and was not sad at all. And that she was like, that's just one example. But there were so many situations where I thought that, like, she would respond like an empathetic, caring little girl that she just didn't.
Weird.
Yeah. They said that, you know, they knew that she was interested in Slender Man, but they didn't think it was strange because, like, lots of little kids that age like ghost stories, like spooky stories.
Yeah.
The mom talks about that when she was that age, she was reading it. It's not surprising that, like, adolescents like scary stuff. But Geyser's mother is skeptical that she would have been the one to come up with a plot to kill Bella on her own. And like I guess in my head, I was like, oh, these girls must have been friends for years. But they had just met at the beginning of that school year when they shared the same bus.
That's so sad.
Alternatively, Geyser and Bella had known each other since kindergarten. And that's where I'm like, the fuck? The fact that she would attack her friend from kindergarten is wild to me. That makes it a little bit fucking worse in my brain, is that it wasn't just some random person. It was like this person who you knew and grew up with.
Yeah. You've seen them grow from being five.
So they also interviewed Weir's father. In the interview, it's very sad. He goes into her bedroom and there's a gray cat in there named Tiger. And he talks about like how the cat stays in the room and like looks for her because like he was her cat. But he talks about the way that people treated him after the attempted murder, and that people would blame him and act like he was just like letting his daughter go on the internet and do whatever she wanted. He talked about the routine and that like she had an iPad so that she could do schoolwork, and her time on it was limited. If she was on like a FaceTime call with somebody, it was for school and he would pop in. He would regularly like, you know, kind of walk up and be like, oh, what are you doing? And unless she was doing choir practice, the bedroom door was open because that was the rule in their house. And then at 7:30 every night, you know, iPad went away and it was family time. That was the typical routine. Later in the documentary, her mother talks about, we started letting her use the iPad more. You can see that she just feels like terrible.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, it hurts my heart because it's like, if she wanted to go look at whatever on the internet, she was going to.
Mm-hmm.
They also interviewed one of Weir's teachers, and he talks about just like how much of an outlier and a loner she was, and that she didn't really have friends. Routinely, she would cry to him about not having friends. And like in his yearbook that she signed, she was like, you've been like a second father to me. And he like gets kind of choked up and he's like, if she felt that way, I wish she would have come to me.
Yeah.
If she was scared or worried. And it's like, you can see that it weighs on him. But I think it just gives a little bit of like context for like perhaps why you might suggest your best friend's other best friend be eliminated if that's your only friend. I'm not saying it's logical, but I could see it as a motive.
That's true. Yeah.
Especially if you've got other mental things going on.
So when psychiatrists examined Geyser to determine whether she was competent to stand trial, Geyser told them that she had telepathic powers and was in telepathic communication with Slenderman, a unicorn, and Lord Voldemort. Interesting list that does not go together at all. Very strange. She was originally deemed not competent to stand trial, but she was later found competent. During the trial, Geyser's attorney said that she believed that she would be killed by Slenderman if she did not kill someone. And he did this to see if she could get her charge lessened to attempted second degree intentional homicide and to have them tried in a juvenile court.
I think that's another fascinating part here, right? Is that they're 12-year-olds being charged as adults.
Yes.
Whatever everything else, to me, that's inherently problematic. I don't think that you should be like, oh, you murdered someone, you're done at 18. But I also don't think treating someone who's 12 like they have a fully formed brain is not a reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So the judge rejected the attorney's kill or be killed belief and also concluded that the girls would not be transferred to juvenile court. Geyser was diagnosed with schizophrenia and her father's mental history was discussed at a hearing. Specifically, her father had similar symptoms as Geyser, and he had been hospitalized at least 4 times when he was about 14 or 15 years old. Geyser was transferred to a psychiatric hospital to begin getting treatment for her schizophrenia. The treatment included medications, and her attorney stated that she reported helped, quote, quell the voices. So Weir and Geyser eventually entered pleas as not guilty by reason of mental disease. So Weir eventually pled guilty to second-degree homicide as a party to the crime with use of a deadly weapon. But her case wouldn't move to trial until her mental condition improved enough for her to be held legally responsible for the crime. So in September of 2017, a jury ruled that Weir should get treatment for the Slenderman delusion that motivated the attempted murder rather than go to prison for the crime. 10 out of 12 jurors agreed that she was suffering a mental disorder when the crime was committed. She was ultimately sentenced to be committed for 25 years, which was the maximum length of supervision. The court determined that she would need to be committed for at least 3 years before she could be reviewed to be released for community supervision. Geyser pled guilty as charged, but is not held criminally liable. So she was ordered to stay at the mental institution where she started to get treatment 18 months prior. Geiser was committed for 40 years. And then, of course, Geiser and Weir attempted to appeal their convictions because they were only 12 at the time of the crime, but they were unsuccessful. In 2001, Weir applied for conditional release, and it was granted later that same year. As part of her conditional release, she will need to meet with the case manager and wear a GPS tracking device until she is 37.
Geiser has also applied for release multiple times, and she was denied. However, their most recent hearing was in January of this year, so January of 2024. And there's additional hearings in April to determine if she could be released. So we'll update that in our True Crime Digest. These are both two girls who were clearly suffering from delusions. From watching their videos, when they're talking about Slender Man, they do seem genuinely
concerned,
enamored, scared, like all of these things. Like, it's clear the belief is real to me.
Yeah, yeah.
So that wraps up today's episode on Topos. So we're not going to do too much of our... Are we calling this section Chocolate Talk Talk, even when we're not talking about chocolate?
Oh, yeah.
We're not going to do too much of opinion talk here on the end, because we're going to save it for our next episode where we have a more robust discussion of, like, just like the implications of, like, what a tulpa could be if this is what a tulpa is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we've mentioned it before, just that the person's mind can do a lot and it's not 100% on, like, its capabilities yet.
Yeah.
And so thinking that, like, this could be a capability is just wild.
Yeah. I mean, we know that we can do a lot and you can change yourself and all these things, but, like, how much can one do? And I'm a believer in not just, like, the things that we absolutely know, but a little bit in the mystical too, right? Because, like, until it's proven, it's not science-y. But just because it's not proven doesn't mean it can't be one day true. Or I'll make up a tulpa in my head about a tulpa.
Well, it's not proven with today's technology. Just like DNA technology has advanced, right? Like, things that we could do today couldn't be done 100 years ago. Same thing could be true.
Yeah. If I told someone from 100 years ago that I had a little magical box that I could draw along with a stick and that I could send it to someone across the country in a second, they'd probably look at me like I was insane.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Well, do you have tulpa questions? Do you want to talk about thought forms? Do you want to tell me that you can see auras? I want to hear all of this.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Also, if you have read Annie Besant's book, I am curious as to what others think. She does go into a lot about, like, the ways that different thought forms, like, look and appear. She has, like, sketches of them.
Mm-hmm.
She's, like, very clear on, like, what jealous love looks like versus pure love, which I just thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
And she goes into a lot about that. We didn't talk about it because it was, like,
it's a lot.
It's not episode proper, if you will. And there was already enough tulpa content. But also, if you hear licking, I have a very special guest on my desk. One, Piccoli de Senorita Pecan Pie, the tiny skin in the apple of my eye. She's giving herself a foot bath. And all animals are welcome in True Creeps, is what you've learned, if you don't know this already.
But should we end this episode?
Yeah, we should probably end this. And with that, have a great weekend. Dream of some tulpas.
Or don't. Thanks for creeping with us.
Thanks for listening, and as always, a special thank you to our patrons who support us via Patreon.
Please see the link in our show notes to learn more about how you, yes you, can begin to haunt the dump, guard vortexes, or even become a scorching Sasquatch.
Ooh. Also in our show notes, you can find the link to our website, more information on our sources, our social media handles, and our merch store.
We'd love for you to keep creeping with us. So if you like this episode, please subscribe, rate, review, and share the show with your fellow creeps and or ghosts.
I beg of you.
I got Loki a new bed, so he's been resting in his bed being good, but I think I have to offer him a new bed every time to get him to stay put.
Oh, what a prince.
Yeah, if it's an old bed, old news.
Pickle has been a little bit more antisocial and sleeping in my closet. So I stepped out of the office and she was like sitting there and I was like, do you want to come sit with me? Because Ben has like a proper cat bed on his desk and that's her spot. That's a Pickle Girl spot. And I have a bed which has become Theo's bed. And I put her on my desk and she was like, don't mind if I do. And like went and laid down.
Cute.
And I sent Ben a picture and he was like, traitor.
I have won her over.
Because she's a mama's girl now. Yeah. I'm like, did I win? Because I used to have like a little setup next to my desk and she was like, no, center of attention or fucking nothing. Everything's a tulpa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like everything that we love is a tulpa.
I'm a tulpa.
You're a tulpa.